is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, November 21st, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, family and child protection lawyer Bobby Olson joins Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian to talk about the legal systems in Canada which handle issues of domestic and family violence. The two explore what is working in these systems and what needs to be improved. As this conversation centers around domestic violence, we ask that audiences please listen with care and sensitivity or skip this one if the subject is triggering. Here are Sarah Sahagian and Bobby Olson in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, I am interviewing the award-winning attorney, Bobby Olson. So today we're going to have a discussion about family law in Canada and how certain aspects of family law actually can make it harder for victims of domestic violence and abuse to flee abuse or move on from it. So thank you for joining us, Bobby.
Well, it's great to meet you. Thank you for having me.
I would love to start with what you see as the biggest flaws in the family legal system, so the family courts, when it comes to how we address and support survivors of domestic violence.
Honestly, I think that the effort and the intentions are very good. I think that we see, you know, constantly evolving process in family law to try to better understand the needs and to better meet the needs. But I think that sometimes the focus becomes kind of in the wrong spots, in the sense that, you know, one of the things, for example, that I hear the most often is how intrusive the process is. And in a sense, it has to be. I mean, for example, disclosure obligations, whether financial disclosure, whether people are attaching social media messages, email messages, things like that. Sometimes when, as lawyers, we've done this so long, it becomes sort of formulaic. You know, I need this, I need this, I need this. And the judges, the same thing. They're hearing, you know, 20 cases a day, for example. And so it can be very easy to forget that there is a period of often years where a person was living in a home trying to keep their privacy, and their phone was being gone through, and their computer was being gone through, and their car was being searched, and they were being tracked. And, you know, all of these different things with today's technology, like that Find My Phone family feature, I see that a lot. People watching where each other are all the time and that sort of thing, that we forget that sometimes when we make these orders demanding that people put their bank statements in or their phone records in or any of these things, that we're actually, to them, the legal system is giving that person that they were afraid of so long all of the things that they just spent years trying to protect. And so, you know, one of the things that we try to do as lawyers is we try to really explain why things have to be given, why orders are made like that, but really try to limit it to only what is really necessary. For example, sometimes bank statements are necessary to know how much someone makes really, especially if they're self-employed, you know, that kind of thing. I think another limitation that we see a lot is, and I want to be careful not to word this wrong, but not every allegation of abuse is real. And those ones make it so much harder for the people for whom it is. You know, we have, you know, on one side of the spectrum, you have people who, from the moment they come in, you can see that they actually have, often they're still in shock and they have been abused and they may not even realize it. And then on the other, you have sometimes people who are very convinced they've been very abused and they explain how, and you can never discount that, but then you also can't discount the fact that there are people who will say they have if they have not, for leverage. And so what the family law system, much like the criminal law system, has to do is it has to try to have rules that stay consistent across everybody, that provide a situation where family matters are dealt with expediently, because often just having it hanging over your head is, you know, the worst part, so that they're going through quickly, that we're getting people to the resources and the support that they need, but that we're not making it harder for the people who are trying to recover from abuse by trying to make sure that we're weeding out the people using that for leverage, you know? And it becomes so common that I once had a case where I walked in, and there were voluminous materials, and the judge who had just been assigned, you know, 5 minutes before, they'd switch courtrooms. And she said, she's a great judge. She said, let me guess. She says he's abusive and he says she's crazy. And I thought about it for a moment and I was like, yeah, that kind of sums this one up. And so we see so many allegations that it can become very difficult for a judge to really be able to know kind of where to fall on that. So what happens is this: we have a no-fault divorce system in Canada, which can be very frustrating for people. But what we try to do as counsel is we try and focus on just what we need to focus on to get the person to a final order that is going to make their lives better. And we try and make sure that they understand that the point of the court system is not therapy. That's, you know, to get to that end goal, to get to those solutions that will make your life better. But really what ends up happening is that as lawyers, we become sort of counselors to try to help the person through that, because it can be, whether at the criminal system or the family court system, it can be horrible to go through. So one of the things that we really start with here is that when someone comes in and they've been abused, often what happens is the internal monologue that they have, the way they talk to themselves, is very much taking over from the person who used to abuse them, you know? And so trying to help people learn, whether with therapists or even in just, you know, changing kind of their daily routines of noticing, are you actually still insulting yourself the way the person used to insult you? Are you constantly self-bashing, criticizing, all of those things that actually can really prevent people from being able to get better, and to try and watch for those things and make sure that, you know, when they're giving us those decisions that they want to make, that they're really making a decision based on what they think is going to make their life better and not fear, you know, things like that.
That's definitely, I mean, I'm sure everyone hopes that their legal counsel will do that for them. Is there sensitivity training for family lawyers that makes sure that family lawyers know how to deal with victims of abuse and how to support them?
I would say there's a lot that's available. We have, so in Ontario, for example, I practice in Ontario and Alberta. And in Ontario, we have required hours per year. Now you choose what you do, and three of those hours are professionalism, which would, you know, lead into that kind of thing. But it's really more something that would have to be self-learned. For judges, they have these conferences where they have this mandatory training. And absolutely, absolutely there is for judges. And you do see, I mean, I started law school, and I joke, in the late 1900s. And you see a very different court system now than what we saw back then. And they were still trying back then. But there are different things that are being developed. So as an example, often at separation, there are criminal charges laid. Often separation doesn't happen from, you know, a conversation like in the movies where people sit down and talk about it and they decide to consciously uncouple. Often there's a horrible situation and the police are called and somebody is taken away and somebody's charged, or both people are charged. And so the family court system has to work around no contact orders. And how do you facilitate parenting time? How do you both be in a courtroom? How do you say we're forcing people to mediate with those power imbalances? We can work around those, but how are we going to do it without keeping the people within a certain distance from each other? And so one of the things I've really seen change is how we respond to what that used to just be a reality, that almost every case, I would say, without it being a hard statistic, about 80% of the files that would come into me, I often represented men, my client had been charged. And so that was just part of handling it. So I see right now a very big difference in the two provinces I mentioned. For example, in Ontario, I still see, you know, those charges happen quite a lot. When I got to Alberta a couple of years ago, I mean, Calgary, they have something called an emergency protection order, an EPO. And if somebody is feeling, they, you can do it on the phone or you can do it in person, and the person can go to a justice of the peace, explain why they feel unsafe, and an immediate, it's like a restraining order, is issued. We call them EPOs. And then what happens is the police then serve that, remove the person from the home. There is a return to like a list date within about 2 weeks. And then they schedule an oral hearing, just like a trial. And that will usually be a couple months away. And so this is what I mean. I know I probably sounded kind of cruel, but this is what I mean by the importance of focusing on the valid ones. Because what really happens is, when I first got here, I thought it was terrible. I thought, how has that survived the charter? You know, that you can just suddenly be removed from your house without any recourse, without anyone hearing from you for 2 months. But what I noticed after being here a period of time is that I don't see the fallacious charges, because there's lots of real charges for sure, but there's also a lot that resolve on peace bond or a lot that didn't need to hit that level of the system that cost that person, sometimes women, sometimes men, sometimes non-binary people, all different people, that would cost them a lot in criminal fees and give the other side some real leverage in their parenting litigation, which then gave kind of more of a reason to lean toward that kind of argument. For me, I would say that where I got a really different view of everything was when I became a complainant in an IPV matter. And the matter went on, I don't want to talk about it a lot, but it went on for about 4 years through all of this like preliminary inquiry and right to close to the eve of trial. And in that process, being a lawyer who was the, you know, I'm used to being able to speak in a courtroom and that wasn't the role I was in. It was very frustrating. It was very confusing. It felt incredibly intrusive. And things I hadn't thought about as a lawyer as much, like when we just casually say, oh, we're going to adjourn that a couple of months. It's not ready to go. I hadn't really noticed anymore after this many years of practicing what that's like for people's mental health, that they're prepared to go. It's hanging over their head. They're trying to live their lives and move forward, but they have this litigation over their head. And now they're ready for a court date that they get to. And now someone very casually and in a good mood tells them, we're moving this. Well, that can make your head explode. That can make your life feel like it's never going to be happy again until this is over with, you know? And so having had that experience has really changed how I give advice to people and how I make the decisions in litigation. And I think that more and more family lawyers are starting to understand that it isn't just get them to the finish line. It's how can I get them through this without making their mental health and their emotional well-being worse than it was when they got here? And I do see, you know, very much a push with family lawyers in general to understand better, to respond better, and to try and make it a more healthy experience. And that's where we get a lot of things like mediation, you know, working with making sure our clients properly have therapists where they need them, things like that.
So thank you for all of that. I'm curious when it comes to specifically child custody. So one interesting thing about the courts that is quite controversial is that just because a partner has experienced domestic abuse doesn't necessarily mean that child custody rights are impacted at all. So could you just explain a little bit about the logic about that and how it might re-victimize survivors of abuse? And also, I mean, just as a parent and somebody who knows children, I feel like it might also put children in a vulnerable position.
It really can. And because one of the patterns that we watch patterns a lot in family law, and one of the patterns that we see a lot is that when you do have one parent who is abusive, when the other parent is out of the home, often then we start to see the concerns with the eldest child. And then at some point that eldest child refuses to go or doesn't have to go. And then it's the next child. And it kind of, you know, moves its way down the line. And we get, you know, family courts are very used to having people not want to give more parenting time for whatever reason. And there's lots of times, like new moms are a good example. For new moms, even giving an extra hour, getting your client to understand that that's going to happen. So it's better that you've, you know, done something a little bit more cooperative so that you're not also dealing with the psychological impact in a regular breakup of the other side just being smug that they won, you know, because that can change the dynamic a little bit too. So you want to be cooperative where you can for a lot of different reasons. But for someone who has come out of an abusive relationship, there's some real terror there when you tell them, well, they haven't done anything in front of the children. They haven't done anything to hurt the children. And the one I would say that, you know, there are horrific cases, and I'm speaking more about the general ones where the abuse is hard to prove. Courts come a very long way in understanding financial abuse, financial control, and how that affects someone basically being too trapped to leave. Right. And all of the kinds of threats that can happen and that kind of situation. So what we try to do, I mean, we have different interventions. We have assessments where psychologists or people with a master of social work will come in all provinces we have this, and territories that they'll come in and they'll get to know each parent. Sometimes there's psychological evaluation of a parent, and then they make different recommendations about the parenting schedule or about who needs to do what service or what kind of therapy. But the reality is that for the most part, that's a very expensive thing to do. You can be spending $20,000 or $30,000 to do that privately. in some provinces, I mean, in all provinces, we have a children's lawyer kind of a system or a voice of the child report or all of these different things. But people will come in and they will say to me, I want a voice of the child report. My children are going to speak. But they don't understand that, first of all, if the other side is saying that, you know, there was no abuse and that they've just alienated the children, a voice of the child report will do nothing, because all it does is, if a child's been brainwashed, they're going to say what they're going to say. So it doesn't do anything to try to take apart two differing opinions for it. So it doesn't help the judge at all. They have in Ontario, the children's lawyer, if they accept the file, there's no cost to the litigant. So that's something. Here in Alberta, they have a legal aid system that can fund some of that, but otherwise that's privately paid as well. So we have these different interventions, but at the end of the day, what everybody is trying to do is really very similar to criminal law, where they're trying to figure out who's telling the truth to try and keep children the most safe. And so, you know, we develop these laws like Kira's Law, for example, and judges were highly trained on that one, to try to identify abuse early in. But the reality is that it can be very difficult to know. You know, I had a file come in where I was very concerned that something was going to happen to the little girl. And I ranted and raved about that. But the other parent had done a significant number of courses. And so when you're the presiding justice and somebody comes in and they've done extensive anger management and they've done, you know, therapy, and they have letters from their therapist and their doctor and a psychologist and certificate after certificate saying they've done all of these different services. Well, for the person who was abused, they're looking at it as he's the same person, smart enough to go to 10 courses, or she. It doesn't change the level of risk. It doesn't change the level of worry. And the reality is that in the face of that kind of evidence, the parenting time is going to happen. And so sometimes we do things like start with it in the community, so there's eyes on the child, or start with it in a therapeutic kind of a setting. But the reality is probably the large majority, even if they have to start at some kind of supervised access center, if that's going well, and most people, I mean, the most abusive people come across as the most normal, let's be honest, right? They can perform. And so they're going to get out of that system relatively quickly. And the reality becomes, sometimes it can be a very difficult thing to prove. And sometimes there's not a lot a court can do other than hope that they're getting it right.
You mentioned a while back that legal aid can be a resource. In Ontario specifically, where I am, legal aid has seen a lot of cuts in recent years. And I'm wondering how that is affecting survivors of domestic abuse who are going through the family law process.
You know, I think that's one of the trickiest parts is that, you know, the legal aid lawyers, those are some exceptional lawyers, because those are the lawyers who are generally in court every single day. Mm-hmm. You know, the expensive lawyers might go 10 times a year. So if I have a legal aid lawyer on the other side, I know I better know what I'm doing. But people don't always realize that. And, you know, they have systems. They have duty counsel at court who are amazing. These people in court, they just run with whoever's showing up that day. And they're incredible lawyers as well. But last I saw the legal aid threshold, I'm sure it's gone up, but it was something like, for a long time, it was something like 24. If you made more than 24,000 a year, or if you made more, it can't possibly be that low anymore, I would hope, but it's not high. And so there is a giant group of people who won't qualify for legal aid, but can't afford a lawyer, right? And so what happens is they come in self-represented, and the court's done things in Ontario like Family Law Information Center at the courthouse to help people know how to fill out the forms and which forms. And in Ontario, there are a lot of forms. They have, you know, there was some discussion in Ontario about whether or not paralegals should be allowed to work in family law. And it's a hot topic. But really accessibility to having a consistent person, certainly not to downplay anything anyone's doing, but having one person who knows your file, who you feel is on your side, I think that that is really invaluable. And I think that realistically, we need to make it easier for people to get lawyers and easier for, you know, to raise that threshold. What ends up happening is almost everybody who comes to see a family lawyer tells relatively a similar story, and they have relatively similar goals. And then we all start emailing each other horrible things to try and make the other side fold. And then if worse comes to worse, there is in Ontario quite a fair amount of a wait to get a court date. And then by the time you get there, whatever the urgent thing was has festered and become 10 things. And now everybody is really angered at each other. And these children are really in the middle of intense tension in their lives. And then somebody who's never met the children and never really met the parties is going to make a decision about your lives. And judges know that. Judges say all the time to people, can the two, you know, the two of you are so much better placed to make this decision than a stranger. But they're aware, we're aware that there are some dynamics where you can't, because they're not equal dynamics. You know, there's sometimes two people who can't have a conversation and both be safe.
Thank you for that. And so I'm just curious, if there were one change that you could see made immediately to the family law system to protect survivors of domestic abuse, what would that change be?
Oh, you'd expect. I would say my gut feeling was financial support, because really that would keep most people trapped, right? If you knew that you could go somewhere safe and be somewhere safe right away, that would save a million criminal charges probably, or EPOs or any of these things. Really, most people just want to be safe and free. But more realistically, I think the thing we have where people are forced to testify whether they want to or not, I think that that's the mistake of all of it, because it creates a situation where we almost take over for the person who is trying to control the person. And now we've given them, you know, more time with this person in their life than they would have had to have if they didn't have to do that. We've given them, you know, more conflict, more fear, because by the time they come to the end of that, say, criminal litigation as an example, now they know the person's really mad. And at some point, those restraining orders run out. So they can end up living a life where they're always watching over their shoulder, always afraid, just wondering when the retribution is coming. I think that survivors of abuse are best placed to know whether or not that prosecution is actually going to make their life better. And what we tell them, well, you have to do it to keep other people safe, and you have to do it so we can track how many people are hurting people. And they really focus on the keeping people of the future safe. But at that moment, that's a lot of responsibility to put on somebody who's just trying to survive, who's just trying to make sure their children are okay. You know, I think that sometimes our intentions, our good intentions, sometimes create a bigger problem. I think that when people are coming out, what I hear the most consistently from people who are coming out of an abusive relationship of all different genders is, I just want to be free. I just want this behind me. So I think giving them more control over actually being able to not have to continue to do this is something. And one of the things I've often thought about is there a sort of a default order that people can opt into, where instead of having to go through all of this, we can say your other option is you can take X. And as much as there might be a lot of people who took the lesser order just because they didn't want to deal with it at the time, I think that sometimes the freedom of just not having to do this, I think sometimes that's what people really need. Because we get very, in family law, we're very big on everyone's entitlements and obligations. And we have to be, because that's the system we're in. But sometimes all you really want is your freedom.
Thank you so much, Bobby. And thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Our listeners, I'm sure, will really appreciate all of your insights. And have a great day to all of our listeners.
Thanks for having me. It was so nice to meet you.
That was family and child protection lawyer Bobby Olson and Rabble's publisher Sarah Sahagian in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Sarah and Bobby. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with news from Toronto. Toronto City Council passed a motion that would allow city administration to clear away homeless encampments within 24 hours if they are located near a school, playground, or daycare. Organizations supporting the unhoused and affordable housing in Toronto argue, however, that this will only exacerbate an ongoing crisis. Like much of Ontario, the construction of new affordable housing units in Toronto has slowed significantly this year. This is in part due to factors such as the resistance of some neighborhoods to have shelters or affordable housing built in their area, as well as due to delays due to bureaucratic red tape at the municipal level. Additionally, building expensive multi-bedroom homes is more profitable for developers than the construction of more affordable 1-2 bedroom apartments. Advocates interviewed by Rabble.ca said that this council's decision to make it easier to clear encampments will only put the vulnerable at risk. In economic news this week, the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board has increased the amount of money it is giving to the fossil fuel industry. The board manages the Canada Pension Plan, which is something that almost all Canadians pay into. Shift Action for Pension Wealth and Planet Health is arguing that by investing in fossil fuels, the board is mismanaging the pension plan's investment portfolio. Fossil fuels are exacerbating the climate crisis, and the continued growth of the fossil fuel industry is a direct threat to humanity's future. Earlier this year, the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board abandoned its commitment for its investment portfolio to become carbon neutral by 2050. Also this week, November is Women Abuse Prevention Month. Meseret Haley-Yesus, Executive Director of the Canadian Centre for Women's Empowerment, was recently recognized for her work in raising awareness of combating the economic abuse of women. Haley-Yesus was given a Governor General's Award in commemoration of the Persons Case. The awards are given to commemorate the 1929 Persons Case, which found that women had rights as persons under Canadian law. The awards are given to individuals and organizations who have done great works in the advancement of women's rights. Economic abuse remains one of the most prevalent forms of abuse that women experience, and can take many forms, such as pay inequity, to having their finances controlled by an abusive partner. Earlier this month, the Liberal government added a financial code of conduct as a part of their recent budget, requiring federally regulated banks to do more to detect and prevent economic abuse. This code of conduct is something that Haley-Yesus has advocated for many years, and she was invited to the House of Commons to give a keynote address prior to the beginning of budget deliberations. And as always, you can read about all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.